Well, I have been interested in Unix, not Linux, for must be about 20 years. And I have been working with it almost constantly for all that time.
Awesome.
And then I got interested in Linux in 1994.
Okay. Now, was this when Slackware was kind of the bigger distribution?
Okay. Yeah. In fact, it was when SLS, Soft Landing Systems, was making a floppy-based distribution. Came on 17 floppies.
Yeah, that took some time. Let's go have some coffee while we wait for it to load. Yes.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Yeah, but it was a lot smaller.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's coming off a long way.
Now SUSE comes on, what, 6 CDs or 2 DVDs?
So it's considerably larger and considerably more user-friendly than it was. So I guess from a new user standpoint, let's just go with what would you recommend somebody getting their feet wet? I mean, obviously, aside from using a resource like we have here at KC Linux Users Group.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Almost any of the GUI-based distros, probably one of the easiest to get started with is Nopix, which you can get on a CD that you can boot from and not even bother your hard disk until you've decided that you want to install it.
So there's a Nopix PC Linux has now come out. I don't know any much about it, but it's
I don't either.
It's a newer GUI-based installer like that that comes on a live, what they call a live CD.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people that don't know, a live CD is simply a bootable Linux CD that basically has the OS on it. So you're not putting it on a hard drive first.
Yeah, it runs entirely from RAM once it's loaded the CD.
And that's a great way to get started. You just kind of get your feet wet in, play with it a little, you know, throw some commands at it, see what it does.
Yep.
So I wanted to kind of throw out some basics tonight, if we could, and, you know, kind of go back to the new users that are listening in. We've been talking a little bit about in the past shell scripting, and I'm doing my best to fill in.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could get them, get the listeners involved in some basic shell scripting. What would be our first? We've got a clean, brand new installation of Linux, and we're assuming we've installed it on our hard drive at this point. And now we want to make it a little more functional for us. So, for example, I wrote one that basically makes it so that I don't have to type what I would normally type as ls-l to get the long listing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I just wrote a really simple shell script. So ls equals, you know, with a link.
Then you didn't know about aliases?
Yeah, alias is what I did there. Okay. In that case. But something like that, I mean, you could do in a shell script just as easy too.
Mm-hmm. Although again, with single line stuff,
right,
very often an alias is a better choice.
That's true.
If you're not passing parameters to it, aliases are the way to go.
I would agree with that. I'm just trying to think of what would be a good thing. Anyways, you're using both cases to kind of automate something that is a little more drawn out. You know, for instance, you can get lines that are, you know, screens wide of commands. So that's the point when you want a shell script maybe to do some of what that does.
Yes, or if you find something that you do quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
For example, say you're a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're doing a story and you keep occasionally going back and doing WC for word count,
right,
of your article.
Right.
You might want to have an alias that does the word count, but on a fixed name,
right,
of what you're doing, so that you might invoke it by just a W command all by itself.
And I guess it's important to note that you don't want to try and stay away from the keyword commands for your shell script names. You know, not that they would mess up, but they could.
Yeah.
And I mean, like don't name an ls based shell script, for example, LS, you know.
Actually, the alias code is supposed to be handled that usually, because
right.
what it does is see if it has applied the alias expansion, and then it looks at the line and says, is there another expansion to do? Does that call me? Mm-hmm. Yes, it does, then don't do it.
Right.
But if it calls something else, go ahead and expand that.
Cool. Now, what is the command alias? How do you set that up? I want to alias my ls command. How do I set that up?
The word alias, A-L-I-A-S, and the space, and the name of the alias, or the thing you're going to invoke it by.
Your name
yeah.
for it. Yes.
Yeah, like for the word count thing, it would be W.
Right.
And then an equal, mm-hmm. and then usually a quote, because you don't want it to expand file names
right.
during the alias definition,
right.
only after when you invoke it.
Yeah, which is a good point with the shell itself. And I'm assuming we're talking about Bash here.
Yes.
Right. So
yeah, that is an interesting thing. With Windows, people were stuck with a single shell. And with Linux, we have Bash, SH, I mean, KSH, mm-hmm. TCSH, mm-hmm. ZSH, mm-hmm. ASH.
Yeah.
It goes on and on.
Yeah. And going back to the Bash shell, which is your, shall I say, default Linux shell,
mm-hmm.
It stands for Born Again Shell, which is, there were two back in the day, so I'm going to go Reader's Digest. Two main shells, the Born and Corn, and they kind of combined all the best features and came up with Bash.
Actually, Bash, in addition to combining some features of SH and KSH, picked up, for example, the history mechanism from CSH, which is the Berkeley shell.
Right.
Which was developed for BSD unit. And that came along and became the public domain version of that. Was Tahoe.
Okay.
And so it became TCSH. And that is the C shell that gets included with Linux.
Thought that was a four-letter word for a long time. No, I'm kidding there, folks. No, that's a great piece of history, because I did not know that.
The history mechanism allows you to refer to a previous command.
Mm-hmm.
The way you invoke history is by an exclamation point.
Okay.
Which, as an old Unix person, I pronounce punctuation.
Right.
And exclamation point is a bang. The asterisk is a star.
Okay.
Well, anyway, when you invoke history, you do it with bang,
right?
And then you can start any previous command. Say a previous command was where is or something. Then you could do bang wh, and it will search back, passing all the things that start with w but not with h, mm-hmm. and find the where is and re-execute that command.
So it's a kind of a search mechanism on what commands I've already executed in my shell.
Yes, and your shell keeps a history. I believe it, by default, is 500 commands in that history. And those do survive between logins. So if you did something yesterday and logged out and logged back in today, that history is still there and can be searched.
Yeah, which is a very good point, because, you know, some things do not actually, they get destroyed upon log out, and that's not one of them.
Along with the bang W,
mm-hmm.
there's a question mark in here. I think it's bang question mark.
Okay.
And the bang question mark says, I'm going to look for a word, which is what you spell after the question mark, but not at the beginning of the command, but somewhere on the line, anywhere on the line.
So
you could look for a file name, for
So it's basically, it's like fill in the blank for you in that history, you know.
It searches the history for the what's called arguments.
Okay.
Instead, the command name comes first, and then the options, that or flags, which are usually hyphen something, some single character maybe, maybe sometimes longer names. And after the options come what's called arguments.
Right.
Arguments are very often file names.
Okay.
They can occasionally be things like some instruction for it to change its behavior.
And then getting a little bit maybe ahead of our discussion here, you can actually chain commands with a pipe character, for example, you know, to get a more involved search like a grep search.
Yep.
So.
And you can have multiple commands on one line separated by semicolon. And in fact, you can do bang W and semicolon bang DA semicolon bang CH or CD or whatever. And that will do all three of those from your history, build that line as though you had typed it in, do any file name expansions, and then execute that sequence of commands.
Which is going to be a pretty slick and powerful thing as you go along, which again, you could make that into a script later.
Yeah.
If you needed to do that on a regular basis.
They, having the commands grow long like that would be tedious and difficult to deal with, except that Bash has the arrow keys that can be used in history as well.
Right.
So you can do an up arrow to go backwards through history. Down arrow goes forward. Left arrow goes from end of command back toward the front.
Okay.
And right arrow goes out toward the end.
So
Control A goes all the way to the beginning, and Control E goes all the way to the end.
That makes sense. Why A though instead of B for beginning? You know, that's what that's one of those questions. You know,
those are Emacs characters. You have to talk with the Emacs people about using that. One of our participants here, Jim Manley, prefers his shell to use the VI characters instead of Emacs.
So he's into torture, is he?
to go back to beginning of line for him, it's a zero.
Right.
And end of line is dollar sign.
Right. So, again, that brings up a point of how customizable that Linux can be for the user. You know, you can customize it to do how you want it to do instead of how it runs out of the box.
Exactly.
And it's not going to complain, or nary shall it complain.
Learning about the customizable features is a great deal of the time you spend with Linux is learning what options you have.
Right.
And choose from those to the experiment to see if you like that better than what you had is what consumes quite a bit of time.
Right. I found, because I'm kind of still a beginner, and I've been using it for 2 years, SUSE 9.3 is where I'm at right now. Mm-hmm. But I still do everything from like KDE, so I'm, you know, kind of scared. But I learned a few things around the command line, and being on the Macintosh the rest of the time, it's got a pretty GUI too that does a lot of things that you do on the command line. But I think that it's always important to remember that, you know, to always know that for a backup, because the GUI will fail. Not that it, you know, can fail, it will. It will lock up at some point, and, you know. So at that point you're left with your command line. So, you know, so it's important to know at least some basics, I feel, on the command line.
Yeah. And at least enough to get your GUI unstuck.
Yeah. And, you know how to kill a process, for example, is one of the big ones in that case, because you're going to kill your X server in the case of Linux, or the session that's locked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, kill all if you're having to do a bunch of them.
And one of the options, to kill all is to give it a command name,
right?
Not number.
Oh, cool.
So you can say kill X, kill all, capital X, and right. that will kill the X server.
Right. So then you have now, you know, got a clean slate when you restart that X server.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing to know. Also,
Red Hat comes with one that's called PIDOV, P-I-D-O-V.
Okay. And PID is a process ID?
Yes.
Right.
And that returns the number for the name you give it.
Okay.
And if there are more than one of them, all their numbers get returned.
That's very handy. I have not seen an implementation like that. Now, I gotta take a step back here and say, you know, since I use Mac OS X and it's FreeBSD under the hood, we are using Bash Shell, but we don't have anything like that.
Well, let me say that I believe the source should be available mm-hmm. for that, and you should be able to download it and compile it
yes,
on
you
your
should.
Mac.
And it'll basically the Mac, for those of us listening that have played with them or are playing with Mac OS X, anything that will compile under FreeBSD on the command line side now will run on your Mac. So it's yeah. not. I'm not talking about the GUI here. I'm not talking about Aqua. I'm just talking about the FreeBSD subset mm-hmm. itself.
Yeah, the GUI stuff is different.
Right, completely.
Yeah. Like in Linux, we have two major branches, KDE and GNOME.
Right.
And the two can share or can run the programs compiled for the other.
Provided the libraries are there, right?
Yeah. But as you were saying, the libraries have to be there.
Right.
And not everything will work in that case.
Yeah, and on the Mac, it's a totally different deal. It's a proprietary GUI, so you're not even able, if you kill it, you've actually hosed the machine. Yeah. It's because they've put it inside the kernel, you know, so, which, you know, to us Linux guys, that could be considered a downside.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the trade-off is that it's probably faster.
If you got a stable system, definitely don't upgrade unless you have to on either side. We even recommend that on the Mac side.
Yep. Yep. If the less frequently you upgrade or recompile your kernel,
right.
the fewer times you're going to be down because something didn't quite work.
Yes.
Some mismatch between the libraries you have on your disk and the ones that this program you're trying to install wants.
Right. Which brings up a good first topic again for the new users is how do I determine I need to upgrade? And, you know, aside from obvious, there's some program I'm thinking of that doesn't seem to run on the way that I've got it.
Yeah.
Aside from that obvious clue, you know, do I need to upgrade? What are the questions we should ask?
I guess that it would come down to if you're looking to increase the performance of your machine,
right.
you might want to upgrade for that.
Right.
having need for a particular software or upgrading because of one increased speed or some functionality in the OS, the kernel, that is not available in your older one.
Right.
For example, Linux up until about 5 years ago did not come with a firewall
right.
built in the kernel. But
right.
now they started with IP chains and
right.
went off to IP tables.
I remember, I think it was called, I forgot. I think IP chains is what I had heard of.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Yep. That was the first firewall within the kernel.
Right. And of course, you could always configure just another Linux box if you've got the resources, you know, to be the firewall. So you got two NICs.
And, yeah. You know. Although it doesn't take much in the way of resources.
Right.
One of our members here, uh-huh. Monty.
Okay.
He had a firewall that was running on a 386 that booted from a 5 1/4 inch floppy. That's what he was using to firewall his house.
Oh, we do
his
know.
His Windows boxes were behind that.
Yeah, we do know that you know, they can fit them into a ROM area now. Yeah. Hence, like your Linksys routers and you know, your routers that are on the market that are also firewalls for the house.
Yeah.
So, and we are talking, you know, home level firewalls. We're not talking corporation level firewalls, like, you know, PIX boxes or, you know, those things. So.
Yeah, they have a limited number of machines they will be able to protect.
So I think that's a very nice thing. The other thing I kind of wanted to throw out is maybe look at hardware before you look at DOS, like RAM. You know, look at your RAM situation if it's a question of why does this program not run.
Yeah.
You know, or,
yeah. Yeah. If you want things to go faster, mm-hmm. and you can fit more RAM in your machine.
Right.
That's going to be the cheapest way to get better performance.
Right, and the least of a headache in the actual, you know, kernel recompilation and so on.
Yes, because a reboot and magically the new memory is included.
So, and that brings me to another personal thing. I have never yet, you know, recompiled a kernel, so... That's something that scares all of us new users that are new to it. You know, it's like, it seems like you do a little dance and then you make it work. And, you know, is there an easy, you know, I don't know, A to C method to do that, you know, to go through it?
I believe there is a how-to available mm-hmm. on building kernel.
Mm-hmm.
It may be out of date. I haven't looked at it in a long time.
Sure.
I started using the my distro that I was using at home was Red Hat.
Right.
And they included a GUI to do the kernel building. You make choices
right.
from menu items and tell it which modules you want to build or whether
right.
you want it built into the kernel or built as a module.
Right.
And then when you're all done, you say, okay, go.
Yeah, and Debian has a mechanism in place also through the use of its, I forgot how you get, you know, files, the automatic git feature, you know, where if there's a newer kernel out there, it'll get the source for you.
Apt-get.
Apt-get. That's right.
A-P-T-G-E-T.
Yeah, see, here I am feeling really silly now. But, yeah, I'm an SUSE guy, remember.
Well, SUSE is using RPM.
Right.
For their stuff.
Which is a lot like Red Hat.
Yeah.
And I do so much through the GUI that it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, you never had to deal with Slackware. Slackware is tar files only.
Oh, wow. So you got to make sure they're in the right place when you then and archive those guys.
Yep. And you get into dependency deadlocks because something depends on something else, but you can't compile that until you compile this new library.
Right.
And this library depends on something else that you haven't even downloaded yet.
Well, sounds like fun for all of us new users.
It's something you don't want, and that's why RPMs were invented.
Right.
And the apt-get does a similar thing, except it does one level better than RPM. RPM will only include the things this particular package depends on.
Right.
Not the things that the things it depends on depends on.
Right.
But apt-get will do multi-level chaining until it goes all the way back, finds the thing that should be loaded first, does that, and then builds back to what you actually wanted to accomplish.
That is sweet. Yeah, because I kind of was looking at that. I never really knew what it was doing in the background. You type the apt-get in whatever package you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
and it goes out and does its thing, and that's what I knew as a user. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a really nice thing. If you don't want to worry about what depends on what and what has to be loaded in which order,
mm-hmm.
handles it all for you.
This might be a good time to also mention that this feature is available under Nopix because it's based on Debian Linux. So AppGet is actually under your NOPX installation. When you take it off the live CD and put it onto the hard drive, you can use AppGet.
Okay.
Which is nice. It's a nice feature. And I don't know. I've never gotten Debian itself to run. But yeah, it's got a little bit of a...
I think I recall having installed it one time, but never did much with it. All I did was go through the installation to follow the GUI they had for the install.
The bouncing ball.
Yeah. And once I had it installed, I just wiped it and put Red Hat back.
Yeah. So are you a Red Hat fan, basically, as far as your favorite distro?
Personal use, yes.
Right.
What I use at work is SUSE.
All right.
Experimented with other distros. It's mostly those two are the ones that interest me.
Yeah. Everybody has their favorites, so I wasn't meaning to draw you into one of those.
No,
you know,
it's like the VI versus Emacs wars, right, or the GNOME versus KDE thing. It's personal preference, folks.
Yeah.
Take what you want, do it, and be proud that it's yours.
That's right, and remember, Linux is Linux when it's installed.
Yep, you get to make it your particular preferences.
Right.
What goes in there in the package is what the distribution vendor or supplier put his choices as to what your starting point you should have. But what goes in or out after that is up to you.
And if you're real ambitious, you can actually make your own distro and your own installer if you're real ambitious.
There's a how-to on that as well. So, in fact, there's a website to do that.
And what do you know off the top of your head what that is?
The phrase Linux from scratch.
Linux from scratch. Okay, so do a Google search for Linux from scratch. You'll probably hit the site one or two in that list. that was kind of nifty.
Command line locate that will look for files of a particular name, and you can use that to find a file somewhere in your hierarchy. What the database it searches is built automatically at like 4 a.m. or something when most sensible people
are sleeping.
And so the machine is idle, so it builds an index for you.
And some of us, on the other hand, are just, you know, obsessive about that sort of thing and stay up too late. But that's okay. We need everybody, you know, in the community. You know, we need everybody. So. And I myself would be an early adopter, so I kind of throw all these things we're talking about to the wind and, you know, do it. You know, what's the latest, greatest thing? I'm going to try it. You know? So know how to revert if you're going to do that. But, that brings another point that I don't think gets talked about enough, and that is backing up. You know, make some sort of backup of the stuff you want to keep, because there will be that time you do something and you'll need to reinstall.
You'll either have a hardware failure or you'll wipe out a portion or even an entire partition of your hard disk.
Yep.
And but you'll want that data back.
That's right. The report's due tomorrow, and I've lost it. This is the scenario we don't want. Better to lose, you know, I don't know, 2 hours of work than 2 years, you know, whatever you want to say. You know? But backing up can be as simple as using the CP command to another, like another removable drive or another a CD.
Yeah.
You know? And so implement some sort of backup procedure, I guess, is my advice there. Would you concur with that?
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
Very seldom, even on a system that the only user is you.
Right.
And you don't consider it very important until something happens and your wife wants that information that came from that email that came in last month.
Right.
And now you have to figure out, what happened to it.
That's right. And so it's a good deal. I mean, just simply copy it somewhere. That's the easiest, most direct way, you know. You know, yeah. Copy it somewhere that's not on the same drive would be the key.
You know? Yes. Yep. Yeah. If you put it, just make a copy on the same drive, you haven't preserved anything. You haven't gained any insurance. All you've used is more storage on the single disk.
I now have two copies on the same drive that just died.
Yeah. It doesn't help much that they're in separate partitions.
Right. So the key there, all you guys out there listening, the new users, back up to something different. CD's a good one, because you're not necessarily trying to have the latest, but something that you can go back to that's not so old. Like, you know, I try and keep my system backed up weekly for like a full system, and then every other day I try and copy my documents out somewhere so that I have, you know, I only lose a day's work.
Yeah.
At the most.
My home system, I only back up about once a week. But again, it's because I don't value what's on there very much. I wipe it out and put new distros in almost constantly anyway.
Right. So for you, it's basically you're not going to suffer from losing a week's worth of whatever you were doing necessarily.
Right.
So that's kind of what you got to weigh out as the user is, how important is this thing that I'm wanting to preserve?
Yeah. You know? Now, when I have been doing some work, for example, editing a text file, I wind up saving the text file every half hour or so.
Yeah.
It doesn't take long, and it's easy to do. Save it off somewhere else so that if something happens to the original file and I trash it, I can get back to what I had a half hour or so ago.
Yeah. This is one of the things I like about the new thumb drives, like the USB key drives or whatever you want to call them. Is those things are great because they can be there and present, you know, the whole time they're out of your way, yet you can back up to them and have something if it goes down.
Yep.
So, or save to them in this case. Like if it's a document, like a word processor document. Then,
Not to ignore the fact that because it's removable, you can take it from home to work or work to a friend or whatever.
Bring it into the users group. Let us see what you're doing. So, you know, we like that. So.
Yeah.
This is what I like is the open exchange of ideas that I seem to see from the community in general. And that's one of the things that's drawn me initially to the group. I've known you not necessarily by name, but by face for several years now. So... because I think I first came to the first KC Lug meeting in probably 1999. So,
a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've been there quite a while.
Yeah. And I mean, we don't get here to every meeting, but we get here as often as we can. And every time, you know, you meet the most interesting folks with a different idea. If you're having a problem with your system, bounce it off somebody here. They may or may not have a solution, but they'll at least sympathize with the pain.
And may have some clues to help you diagnose the problem.
Right. Yeah. I like to cite Hal Dustin's sound card issue that he's been having lately. We have a IRC channel, which is KC Lug, I think it's just it, isn't it? but it's on Freenet, on the Freenet on IRC. And Hal's on there every once in a while, and he was having a kernel problem with his sound card, and he's been getting ideas on what he can try, and actually tries them. And albeit it's not solved yet, but we've all had ideas. Or maybe it is solved yet, but I mean, I don't know that for sure. As of the last time we met, it was not solved. Which, when I say we, I meant KC Lug is a group.
Okay.
But it was things like that where you got, you know, a consortium of people to talk at and get ideas off of, because I've exhausted everything and beat my head against the wall.
Sometimes a fresh pair of eyes can look at something and say, why is that that way?
Yes.
And you say, what? I looked at that 50 times. I never saw that.
Yeah. I've been looking at it since 2 o'clock this morning.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So that's the whole, I believe, the whole purpose for our existence. And, you know, it's a good opportunity. So I'm kind of, you know, shameless plugging our group. But, you know.
It's fun.
Yeah, and we do. We have a lot of fun here. It's like I was alluding to earlier. We've talked about how you can butcher the English language earlier. That wasn't Linux related, but you know.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about Mac OS.
Right.
It's not Linux related, but it's a topic that interests you and some of the other people here.
Right.
And
our former guest guy, yes.
Yeah. That's, what it's all about is to have the communication between our members.
Right.
To help each other to learn more.
Right. And that's exactly the charter. If you wanted to say we had a charter, that would be the charter of the group.
Yeah.
And on the note of the reason that we can talk about Mac OS X is because, again, it's FreeBSD underneath. And so people here actually have perspectives to help, you know, even though if they don't understand the GUI or don't like the GUI or what have you, you know. The underneath of it, you know, I run into this problem. Here's the command. Here's the way it looks. Well, what's wrong with that is I think, you know, that switch doesn't exist under BSD, for example.
Yeah.
So there's always a different perspective, again, another set of eyes to help, even if you're not necessarily running Linux, per se. And I'm using quotes in there again, guys. Sorry about that. No, you can't see it. You know.
Yep.
Unix is pretty universal in that way. In, you know.
Yes. So. Although there was a great deal of publicity that claimed made a hoopla about the incompatibilities of Unix, because all the major vendors had little extensions, and some had some convenient utilities that they had that nobody else had, because it wasn't part of standard Unix. And the journalists made a great deal of noise about that, but as I experienced it as a system administrator for lots of people, the people I dealt with never noticed that Unix had changed.
Right.
When we migrated from one machine to another, the commands that they had been using were still there.
Right. There used to be two definite camps, and BSD was the one side, and I now forget because you don't see that too much. It's like AIA.
System 5.
System 5, that's right.
Yes.
So I kind of, this is opinionated, what I'm about to say, because, I mean, I can only express it as my opinion because I have no facts to back up what I'm about to say. But I think they did take some System 5 niceties and put them in the BSD subsystem eventually, and vice versa.
Yes. Yes, they have migrated toward each other.
Right.
And the Linux comes from the GNU utilities, and the GNU folks took the best of both and recoded the whole thing. They rewrote their own, so they didn't have to have source code from either one and weren't locked in, and they could make theirs behave like either one, like the PS command, the process status command from GNU has a personality that will allow it to accept the BSD option flags or the System 5 option flags. And all you have to do is be consistent on a particular command line. You can't mix the two.
That could be interesting at best. But yeah, a lot of people grew up on one or the other, so that would be a good implementation, you know, because you either grew up here on the System 5 side or on the BSD side, and so you're familiar
and
with those commands.
Sometimes it turns out that you're most times you use one, but occasionally you want a feature that just happens to be available in the other and not in the one you use most frequently. And the GNU stuff is great because you have access to both.
And I think that's what I've seen. So it's a good time to be in the Unix world, in the Unix side of the world.
Yeah. And in fact, we're beginning to see things like Solaris is now installing the GNU utilities as part of what gets shipped from Sun, so that we're now coming back full circle, where before they were trying to make themselves different and do specialized commands that were only available on their. Now, because of the GNU utilities, we're getting to a standard set of commands and options that port across all the systems.
And that's a good deal. I mean, we needed this sort of standardization, I think, for a long time in the Unix world.
You know? Yeah.
And so I'm real proud to be on it, especially in light of what's going on in the Windows world. No offense to those of you out there using it, but, you know, seems to me like every time it turns around, my poor mom-in-law has a new virus.
The thing that struck me about Windows is that because of its DOS heritage, it has always been, to my way of thinking, like a toy. It may be fast, but it doesn't do a whole lot compared to what Unix can do. The world with Unix or Linux is so much larger. Your number of options, your horizons have opened up quite a bit. Again, it is your system. You can customize it the way you want. That's what I was saying about not only what comes in, but what you remove, your choice.
It's basically, you can't hurt it unless you remove the library that's required by one of your packages that's installed, or you remove the kernel itself. You can't really hurt it. Yeah. Yeah. So that's I guess, an open invitation to say, do feel free to play around in there. Ask us questions if you come to the meetings, you know, if you run into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Read the how-tos. Lots of people will point you to that, but they're very helpful. The people have written down, people have taken the time to write down in detail common things we run into. So those are very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Little short tutorials, usually about 1,500 to 2,500 words of explanation of what it is that he's going to show you how to do and the steps needed to make that functional.
And as a general rule, if it's a how-to, it's in the proper format for a how-to, if it's a Unix how-to. So like a manual page is in a man page, you know, format.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. You know.
Although, as I've said in previous interviews here, man pages were not meant to be a tutorial. They're like an encyclopedia reference material. You don't go to the encyclopedia to learn to speak English. So you don't use man pages as a tutorial. You buy some external book, like your Linux Power Tools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or Matt Welch wrote one called Running Linux.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good book also.
Yeah, one of the first. And there's even a Unix for Dummies.
And that's going to be even maybe even more clear for somebody just getting into it, you know, because of the way that IDG formats those books.
I see.
Not because the information's any better or worse.
Just yeah. Presented in a familiar format.
So it's kind of in digestible chunks, I guess is the best way to put it, for the average general person, you know?
Yep.
So there's a really good line of books. Also, if you're going to use the Bash shell, which again was the default shell when you install your Linux, the one that will be there first, the Bash shell by O'Reilly, learning the Bash shell is a good book to have if you're going to use it mainly.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, insert the shell you have. There's a book on it.
Oh, did you know that there's a how-to on Bash prompts?
I didn't know that.
You can customize your Bash prompt to do things like do multicolors and put portions of the prompt into inverse video and stuff like that.
There's a way to save those. You could do those on the command line, but how do you do that? It's a .dot file. I forgot which one it is. I think it's login or profile. .dot profile.
Well, the sh starts with dot profile. Actually, I guess it starts with etc profile.
Okay.
And then goes to your home directory, mm-hmm. dot profile.
Right.
The dot as the first character of the file name is a hidden file. It's not listed when you do ls.
It's not listed.
And so...
Or just deciding to say you like your prompt blue and you want to save that state.
Yep. And then after dot profile, the bash shell runs dot bash underscore login. Then goes on to bash rc. Whereas the born shell and the corn shell, the born shell stops at dot profile in your home directory.
Right.
The corn shell goes on to ksh underscore login. The C shell goes to dot login. And, well, in Linux, it would be tcsh.
Right.
Because,
right.
Yeah. But as an old BSD person, I refer to it as C shell. ksh. KSH, after it does login, it goes to KSHRC.
Mm-hmm.
Then TCSH starts with dot login mm-hmm. and goes to dot CSHRC.
Mm-hmm. So that's which one do we want to edit with our editor of choice, be it, you know, Pico or whatever?
Nano.
You want. Nano is even better, yeah. Nano being the, I believe that's a GNU.
Yes, it is.
Right. It's a very nice editor for somebody that doesn't want to get into the intricacies of VI or, you know, Emacs editors.
Right.
So it's a great down and dirty, is the way I'll put it, editor.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. I'd look upon Nano as sort of like ED is for DOS.
Okay.
It's not an editor that you would use to edit major jobs, but it's easy to get things, short things done quickly.
So getting into that, what file do we want in the Bash shell, for example, to edit to make our prompt changes stay that we have implemented?
Okay. You probably want that in .bashrc.
Right.
Because the dot bash login executes only one time when you first log in. So same thing for dot profile. Again, the order is etc profile,
right?
Then home directory dot profile, then dot bash underscore login, and then dot bash rc.
Okay.
Dot bash rc though is executed every time you call a command. It executes dot bash rc before running the command.
Okay. So if I let my prompt blue and I say prompt, you know, blue or however you specify color in there, and I want that to be persistent next time I log in, then I want to put it in that rc file.
Yes. Yeah. What you do is the prompt that receives is named capital P, capital S,
right.
One.
Right.
There are 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
And the prompt you see at the ordinary command shell waiting for input is PS1.
Right, which would be just a slash in the greater than sign.
By default, yes.
You're right. And you can change this too. You can make it ridiculous and go to like whatever directory you're in and, you know, have the prompt be ridiculous
and
long.
You can include the date and time.
Right.
And the name of the machine you're on.
Which for most of us at home, it'll be something arbitrary anyways because you didn't have a domain specific. So you named it Lucy. And so now you got Lucy on your prompt. Yeah. Oh, that's where that came in.
Yeah.
So domain names are a whole nother subject, guys. But yeah, but yeah, you can be ridiculous with the prompt, or you can have it be as simple as it comes default.
Domain names were invented because the internet grew to where early on we did not have websites. Everyone who wanted to exchange files with somebody put up what was called an FTP server, standing for File Transfer Protocol. And the FTP servers, many of them required a username and password to log in there. Some put up what were called anonymous FTP servers, where you could just log in as username FTP and give your email address instead of a password. You didn't have to key anything, but it became a courtesy for the guy who was running it to look in his logs and see the email address
right.
Who was logging into his machine. And
kind of good etiquette.
That list of those anonymous FTP servers, when it got to about a quarter megabyte, people began to think, this is too big. You have to have some other way of keeping track of this so that we don't have to propagate a quarter meg file from or changes to a standard file from one site to another.
The background, people, in case you didn't hear that, is we're advising somebody to get on a dial-up. I have not an idea why. Yeah, I kind of take my cable for granted now. I said to my wife just the other day, hey, let's go back to dial-up. She said, not on my life, and meaning my life, not hers.
Yep. Once you've got that speed, it's kind of hard to go back.
That's right. Did you have any other thoughts for the users on, you know, beginning shells and, you know, basically, again, the GUI's there if you installed it and you did it totally default in most distros. The GUI's there when you log in. Yeah.
We mentioned at least the PS command.
Right.
PS all by itself, just PS, no right. arguments, will list what processes you have started since you logged in, including the PS itself.
Which is a process.
So yes.
PS is short for process server, is that right?
Process status.
Status. Okay. Yeah, process status and PS. Just remember processes and PS comes out that way.
The most common Unix and Linux commands were given two character names. That's because a single character you can very often mistype and you don't have all that many choices. There's only 26 of them to begin with, unless you go upper and lowercase.
That is correct.
Would give you 52. But by combining two of them, we get into hundreds of them with a very short string. So the most frequently used commands were two or three characters.
And examples of this are ls, which gives you your list of files. And I'm not sure what the L, what the S is in that one, if there was actually a name or whether it was just shortened list or, you know, what they did.
I believe it was just shortening up list.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can get, obviously, there's
also there is DIR available.
Really?
Yes, DIR gives you a lookalike to DOS dir command.
Wow.
It
reformats
the, and it's a modified version of LS that gives you a DOS formatted output.
Yeah, and again, folks, if this doesn't exist, you can actually write this yourself if you wanted to do it. You could make a little script that would take LS and format it how you want it.
As I recall, actually what happens is LS and LL and just L, all by itself, and Dir, and maybe some others that I've forgotten, all of them are separate names that point to the same executable. And then what name you invoke it by determines how it behaves by default.
Again, it's that idea of personalities for a command.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So depending on which name you chose is what personality it will show you. So it's definitely like Sybil, you know, itself. But
yeah. Some other two-letter commands are TR.
Mm-hmm.
TR is translate.
Right.
One set of characters to another.
Mm-hmm.
That's used for things like translating lowercase to uppercase or upper to lower.
Right, which would be a good time to point out because we were talking to some new users. The Unix environment is case sensitive. That means that capital C-A-T dot doc and lowercase C-A-T dot doc are different files.
Yes.
So that's important to note.
Yep. And actually, file names can be, in Linux, they can be at least 255 characters long. I believe some of the new file systems can go beyond that. But at least 255 characters long. Those characters can be anything except a null or a slash. You can't use slash because a slash is a directory separator, and that's built in kernel.
That would be like a keyword in programming. You know, you can't use it in certain instances, and that's one. So you confuse the machine, so to speak. You know?
Yeah. So I have seen people come from a Mac environment to a Unix one, and they're surprised that they cannot use the slashes in dates.
Not true anymore. It's absolutely, you can't do it anymore in Mac because of the new OS.
I see. So,
if you're an old school Mac person, you know, you're going to have to get with the now. So,
I see.
But yeah, that's a good point. Coming from any other environment into there, it's not going to be the same. There's always a slight thing. There's similarities and there's differences.
Yeah. I said that it can be any character except null
right.
and slash. That includes control characters.
So you want to hide that character from your mom, you know, there it is.
Yeah. You can name a file dot tab space. And I guarantee not many people will find it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
they
I'm doing a search.
See it there, but they can't get to it.
Why can't I get into my file? Did you put in a space? Yes, I did. Well, if you mean space, that's great. Conventional speaking in file naming, you want to use an underscore where there would be a space.
Yes.
You know, in convention. I'm not talking about you have to do that, but it's a convention.
Yeah.
So
I've also personally developed the habit of capitalizing the words and just string a phrase together.
Okay.
No spaces, no underscores, just every word starts capitalized.
So it's kind of like a camel effect, like the camel phrases.
Yes.
For instance, my document would be capital M Y, capital D, and then the rest of this document. So.
Yep. That's a personal habit I developed.
It makes it much more readable and clearer when you're looking at the hodgepodge of characters on your screen because they kind of stand out a little bit. The words stand out a little more if you do this.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And whereas the reason I started doing that was because on my display, the underscore, if it happened to be on the bottom line of the screen,
disappears, huh?
Yes. So underscores weren't a good choice. So I figured, well, at all.
That's one good way around it. Something to distinguish for your own mind your own thinking, because again, we're getting back to this is your machine and it's got to work for you. If you do something, you forget it, you just kind of hosed yourself. So, which kind of brings me to another a new user point is passwords and the developing of passwords. My own experience says do something that's at least 8 characters long nowadays. Do it if you got. It's always a good idea to alternate letters and numbers. If you want to remember it, you can do things like if it's the word Kate, you got K A T and then the letter 3, and it's still Kate, but I mean it's got a number in it now. And
yeah,
you know.
Or you can do a phrase and just take a single letter from each word of the phrase, like Mary had a little lamb.
Okay,
and then some numbers.
Okay, well, we're out of time, guys. So thank you, Ed. And it's been nice talking to you tonight.
Yep, it's been fun. Thank you.